This is Audible.
Audible Inc. presents The Unbecoming of Mara Dyer, written by Michelle Hodkin, narrated by Christy Romano.
Acknowledgements. I owe many people many thanks for their unwavering support of Mara Dyer and me. To my editor, Courtney Bongiolotti, for doing everything right. You have been Mara's champion from the beginning, and I cannot be more grateful. To my publisher, Justin Chanda, for taking a big chance on my strange little book and for loving the creepy stuff as much as I do. To my agent, Barry Goldblatt, for being my white knight and not believing in the word impossible. To my incredible publicist, Paul Crichton, to Chrissy Noe, Sienna Conksol, Matt Pantoliano, Lucille Rattino, Laura Antonacci, and the entire talented team at Simon & Schuster for their boundless enthusiasm and dedication. And to Lucy Ruth Cummins for designing the cover that blows everyone away. To Beth Revens, Rachel Hawkins, Kirsten Miller, and Cassandra Clare for their generosity. To Cami Garcia for literally more than I can say. To Jody Meadows and Sandra Mitchell for their pitch-perfect advice. To Cody Keplinger for making me feel like I belong. And to Veronica Roth, the Dauntless, for being one of the bravest people I know. To all of my kind and witty and intelligent blog and Twitter friends, you have made every second of this wild ride more fun. Thank you for sharing my journey and for honoring me by allowing me to share yours. To my rescuers, in every sense of the word, you know who you are. The world is a better place because you're in it. To my readers, Amanda, Noelle, Sarah, Allie, and Mary, for your insight. And to the tireless soldiers in my beta army, Emily L., for loving Noah first. Emily T., for loving Noah without being asked. Christy, for telling me no when I needed to hear it. Becca, for being my plot goddess. Kate, for numerous 11th-hour miracles. And to Natan, for always counting my bullets. I would count the ways in which I am grateful, but I don't have enough fingers and toes, and we know that's all I'm good for. To Stella, for couch space and over a decade's worth of apartments, and to Stephanie, for doing it all first. I don't say it enough, but I love you. To the people who make me feel like I've won the family lottery every day, my one and only Tante, Helene, and Uncle Jeff, for Passage, for Dulong, for Jacob, Zeb, Esther, Yehuda, Simcha, and Rachul. To Jeffrey, for so much. To Brett and Melissa, for the Blair Witch, among other awesome things. To Barbara and Peter for being Barbara and Peter. To Aunt Viri and Uncle Paul for inspiring my favorite line in the sequel. And also the whole lifetime of support thing. And to Yordana Hodkin, I adore you. To Andrew, for giving me the best gifts. For being so much nicer than I could ever hope to be. You deserve a medal or 10,000. To Nanny and Zadie, Z-L. You would love how this is all turning out. To Janie and Grandpa Bob for being my biggest cheerleaders from the moment I was born and every day since. To Martin and Jeremy for being the second and third show ponies in a line. For always being in my heart, even though we're far apart. For making me thrilled to not have sisters. And to my mother for reaching things on high shelves. For the Joss Bird. For Brandy. For helping me be a singer and not an acrobat. For being the ultimate woman of valor. Words will never be enough. Last but certainly not least, thank you for listening to this book. I can't wait to share what happens next. For Grandpa Bob, who filled my imagination with stories. For Janie, who made all the other kids jealous. And for my mother, who loves me too much. The Unbecoming of Mara Dyer by Michelle Hodkin. My name is not Mara Dyer, but my lawyer told me I had to choose something, a pseudonym, a nom de plume, for all of us studying for the SATs. I know that having a fake name is strange, but trust me, it's the most normal thing about my life right now. Even telling you this much probably isn't smart. But without my big mouth, no one would know that a 17-year-old who likes Death Cab for Cutie was responsible for the murders. No one would know that somewhere out there is a B student with a body count. And it's important that you know, so you're not next. Rachel's birthday was the beginning. This is what I remember. Mara Dyer, New York City. Chapter 1. Before. Laurelton, Rhode Island. The ornate script on the board twisted in the candlelight, making the letters and numbers dance in my head. They were jumbled and indistinct like alphabet soup. When Claire pushed the heart-shaped piece into my hand, I startled. I wasn't normally so twitchy, and hoped Rachel wouldn't notice. The Ouija board was her favorite present that night, and Claire gave it to her. I got her a bracelet. She wasn't wearing it. Kneeling on the carpet, I passed the piece to Rachel. Claire shook her head, oozing disdain. Rachel put down the piece. "It's just a game, Mara," she smiled, her teeth looking even whiter in the dim light. Rachel and I had been best friends since preschool, and where she was dark and wild, I was pale and cautious. But less so when we were together. She made me feel bold, usually. "I don't have anything to ask dead people," I said to her. "And at 16, we're too old for this," I didn't say. "Ask whether Jude will ever like you back." Claire's voice was innocent, but I knew better. My cheeks flamed, but I stifled the urge to snap at her and laughed it off. "Can I ask it for a car? Is this like a dead Santa scenario?" "Actually, since it's my birthday, I'm going first." Rachel put her fingers on the piece. Claire and I followed her. "Oh, Rachel, ask it how you're gonna die." Rachel squealed her assent, and I shot a dark look at Claire. Since moving here 6 months ago, she'd latched onto my best friend like a starving leech. Her twin missions in life were now to make me feel like the third wheel and to torture me for my crush on her brother, Jude. I was equally sick of both. "Remember not to push," Claire ordered me. "Got it. Thanks. Anything else?" But Rachel interrupted us before we could descend into bickering. "How am I gonna die?" The three of us watched the board, my calves prickled from kneeling on Rachel's carpet for so long, and the backs of my knees felt clammy. Nothing happened. Then something did. We looked at each other as the piece moved under our hands. It semicircled the board, sailing past A, through K, and crept past L. It settled on M. "Murder?" Claire's voice was soaked with excitement. She was so sketchy. What did Rachel see in her? The piece glided in the wrong direction, away from U and R, landing on A. Rachel looked confused. "Matches? Mauling?" Claire asked. "Maybe you start a forest fire and get eaten by Smokey the Bear?" Rachel laughed, briefly dissolving the panic that had slithered into my stomach. When we first sat down to play, I had to resist the urge to roll my eyes at Claire's melodramatics. Now, not so much. The piece zigzagged across the board, cutting her laughter short. R. We were silent. Our eyes didn't leave the board as the piece jerked back to the beginning. To A. Then stopped. We waited for the piece to point out the next letter, but it remained still. After 3 minutes, Rachel and Claire withdrew their hands. I felt them watching me. "It wants you to ask something," Rachel said softly. "If by it you mean Claire, I'm sure that's true." I stood up, shaking and nauseous. I was done. "I didn't push it," Claire said, wide-eyed as she looked at Rachel, then at me. "Pinky swear?" I asked, with sarcasm. "Why not?" Claire answered with malice. She stood and walked closer to me, too close. Her green eyes were dangerous. "I didn't push it," she said again. "It wants you to play." Rachel grabbed my hand and pulled herself up off the floor. She looked straight at Claire. "I believe you," she said, "but let's do something else." "Like what?" Claire's voice was flat, and I stared right back at her, unflinching. "Here we go." "We can watch the Blair Witch Project, Claire's favorite, naturally. How about it?" Rachel's voice was tentative but firm. I tore my eyes away from Claire's and nodded, managing a smile. Claire did the same. Rachel relaxed, but I didn't. For her sake, though, I tried to swallow my anger and unease as we settled in to watch the movie. Rachel popped in the DVD and blew out the candles. 6 months later, they were both dead. Chapter 2.
After.
Rhode Island Hospital, Providence, Rhode Island. I opened my eyes. A persistent machine beeped rhythmically to my left. I looked to my right. Another machine hissed beside the bedside table. My head ached and I was disoriented. My eyes struggled to interpret the positions of the hands on the clock hanging next to the bathroom door. I heard voices outside my room. I sat up in the hospital bed, the thin pillows crinkling underneath me as I shifted to try and hear. Something tickled the skin under my nose. A tube. I tried to move my hands to pull it away, but when I looked at them, there were other tubes, attached to needles, protruding from my skin. I felt a tugging tightness as I moved my hands, and my stomach slithered into my toes. "Get them out," I whispered to the air. I could see where the sharp steel entered my veins. My breath shortened and a scream rose in my throat. "Get them out," I said louder this time.
"What?"
asked a small voice, whose source I couldn't see. "Get them out," I screamed. Bodies crowded the room. I could make out my father's face, frantic and paler than usual.
"Calm down, Mara."
And then I saw my little brother, Joseph, wide-eyed and scared. Dark spots blotted out the faces of everyone else, and then all I could see were the forest of needles and tubes, and felt that tight sensation against my dry skin. I couldn't think. I couldn't speak. But I could still move. I clawed at my arm with one hand and ripped out the first tube. The pain was violent. It gave me something to hold on to. "Just breathe. It's okay. It's okay." But it wasn't okay. They weren't listening to me, and they needed to get them out. I tried to tell them, but the darkness grew, swallowing the room. "Mara?" I blinked but saw nothing. The beeping and hissing had stopped. "Don't fight it, sweetie." My eyelids fluttered at the sound of my mother's voice. She leaned over me, adjusting one of the pillows, and a sheet of black hair fell over her almond skin. I tried to move, to get out of her way, but I could barely hold my head up. I glimpsed two dour-faced nurses behind her. One of them had a red welt on her cheek. "What's wrong with me?" I whispered hoarsely. My lips felt like paper. My mother brushed a sweaty strand of hair from my face. "They gave you something to help you relax." I breathed in. The tube under my nose was gone, and the ones from my hands, too. They were replaced by gauzy, white bandages wrapped around my skin. Spots of red bled through. Something released itself from my chest, and a deep sigh shuddered from my lips. The room shifted into focus now that the needles were out. I looked at my father sitting at the far wall, looking helpless.
"What happened?" I asked hazily.
"You were in an accident, honey," my mother answered. My father met my eyes, but he didn't say anything. Mom was running this show. My thoughts swam. An accident. "When?"
"Is the other driver?"
I started, but couldn't finish. "Not a car accident, Mara." My mother's voice was calm, steady. It was her psychologist voice, I realized.
"What's the last thing you remember?"
More than waking up in a hospital room, or seeing tubes attached to my skin, more than anything else, that question unnerved me. I stared at her closely for the first time. Her eyes were shadowed, and her nails, usually perfectly manicured, were ragged.
"What day is it?"
I asked quietly. "What day do you think it is?" My mother loved answering questions with questions. I rubbed my hands over my face. My skin seemed to whisper on contact.
"Wednesday?"
My mother looked at me carefully.
"Sunday."
"Sunday?" I looked away from her, my eyes roaming the hospital room instead. I hadn't noticed the flowers before, but they were everywhere. A vase of yellow roses were right beside my bed, Rachel's favorite. A box of my things from the house sat in a chair next to the bed. An old cloth doll my grandmother had left to me when I was a baby lounged inside, resting its limp arm around the rim.
"What do you remember, Mara?"
"I had a history test Wednesday. I drove home from school and..." I rifled through my thoughts, my memories. Me, walking into our house, grabbing a cereal bar from the kitchen. Walking to my bedroom on the first floor, dropping my bag and taking out Sophocles' 3 Theban plays. Writing, then drawing in my sketchbook. Then nothing.
A slow, creeping fear wound its way around my belly. "That's it," I told her, looking up at her face. A muscle above my mother's eyelid twitched. "You were at the Tamerlane," she started. "Oh, God." "The building collapsed. Someone reported it about 3 a.m. Thursday. When the police arrived, they heard you." My father cleared his throat. "You were screaming." My mother shot him a look before turning back to me. "The way the building fell, you were buried in a pocket of air in the basement. But you were unconscious when they reached you. You might have fainted from dehydration, but it's possible that something fell and knocked you out. You do have a few bruises," she said, pushing aside my hair. I looked past her and saw her torso reflected in a mirror above the sink. I wondered what a few bruises looked like when a building fell on your head. I pushed myself up. The silent nurses stiffened. They were acting more like guards. My joints protested as I craned my head over the bed rails to see. My mother looked in the mirror with me. She was right. A bluish shadow blossomed over my right cheekbone. I pushed my dark hair back to see the extent of it, but that was it. Otherwise, I looked normal. Normal for me, and normal, period. My gaze shifted to my mother. We were so different. I had none of her exquisite Indian features. Not her perfect oval face or her lacquered black hair. Instead, my father's patrician nose and jaw were reflected in my own. And except for the one bruise, I did not look like a building had collapsed on me at all. I narrowed my eyes at my reflection, then leaned back against the pillows and stared at the ceiling. "The doctor said you're going to be fine," my mother smiled faintly. "You can come home tonight, even, if you feel well enough." I lowered my gaze to the nurses. "Why are they here?" I asked my mother, staring straight at them. They were creeping me out. "They've been taking care of you since Wednesday," she said. She nodded at the nurse with the welt on her cheek. "This is Carmela," she said, then indicated the other nurse. "And this is Linda." Carmela, the nurse with the welt on her cheek, smiled, but it wasn't warm. "You have some right hook." My forehead crumpled. I looked at my mother. "You panicked when you woke up before, and they had to be here when you woke up just in case you were still disoriented."
"Happens all the time," Carmela said. "And if you're feeling like yourself now, we can go."
I nodded, my throat dry. "Thank you. I'm sorry."
"No problem, sweetie," she said.
Her words sounded fake. Linda hadn't said a word the whole time.
"Let us know if you need anything."
They turned and walked synchronously out of the room, leaving me and my family alone. I was glad they were gone, and then I realized that my reaction to them was probably not normal. I needed to focus on something else. My eyes swept the room and finally landed on the bedside table on the roses. They were fresh, unwilted. I wondered when Rachel brought them. "Did she visit?" My mother's face darkened.
"Who?"
"Rachel." My father made a strange noise, and even my mother, my practiced, perfect mother, looked uncomfortable. "No," my mother said. "Those are from her parents." Something about the way she said it made me shiver.
"So she didn't visit?" I said softly.
"No." I was cold, so cold, but I had started to sweat.
"Did she call?"
"No, Mara." Her answer made me want to scream. I held out my arm instead. "Well, give me your phone. I want to call her." My mother tried to smile and failed miserably. "Let's talk about this later, okay? You need to rest." "I want to call her now." My voice was close to cracking. I was close to cracking. My father could tell.
"She was with you, Mara. Claire and Jude, too," he said.
"No." Something tightened around my chest, and I could barely find the breath to speak. "Are they in the hospital?" I asked, because I had to, even though I knew the answer just looking at my parents' faces.
"They didn't make it,"
my mother said slowly.
This wasn't happening. It couldn't be happening. Something slimy and horrible began to rise in my throat.
How did they die?" I managed to ask.
"The building collapsed," my mother said calmly.
"How?"
"It was an old building, Mara. You know that."
I couldn't speak. Of course I knew. When my father moved home to Rhode Island after law school, he'd represented the family of a boy who had been trapped inside the building. A boy who died. Daniel was forbidden from going there. Not that my perfect older brother ever would.
Not that I ever would. But for some reason I had. With Rachel, Claire, and Jude. With Rachel. Rachel. I had a sudden image of Rachel walking boldly into kindergarten, holding my hand. Of Rachel turning out the lights in her bedroom and telling me her secrets, after she had listened to mine. There was no time to even process the words, Claire and Jude too, because the word Rachel filled my mind. I felt a hot tear slide down my cheek. What if she was just trapped too? I asked. Honey, no. They searched. They found. My mother stopped. What? I demanded, my voice shrill. What did they find? She considered me, studied me. She said nothing. Tell me, I said, a knife's edge in my voice. I want to know. They found remains, she said vaguely. They're gone. Mara, they didn't make it. Remains. Pieces, she meant. A wave of nausea rocked my stomach. I wanted to gag. I stared hard at the yellow roses from Rachel's mother instead, then squeezed my eyes shut and searched for a memory, any memory of that night. Why we went, what we were doing there, what killed them. I want to know everything that happened. Mara. I recognized her placating tone, and my fingers curled into fists around my sheets. She was trying to protect me, but she was torturing me instead. You have to tell me, I begged, my throat filled with ash. My mother looked at me with glassy eyes and a heartbroken face. I would if I could, Mara, but you're the only one who knows. Chapter 3. Laurelton Memorial Cemetery, Rhode Island. The sun reflected off the polished mahogany of Rachel's coffin, blinding me. I stared, letting the light sear my corneas, hoping the tears would come. I should cry, but I couldn't. Everyone else could, though, and did. People she never even spoke to. People she didn't even like. Everyone from school was there, claiming a piece of her. Everyone except Claire and Jude. Their memorial service was that afternoon. It was a gray and white day, a biting New England winter day. One of my last. The wind blew, lashing my curls against my cheeks. A handful of mourners separated me from my parents, silhouettes of black against the colorless, unbroken sky. I hunched into my coat and wrapped it tighter around my body, shielding myself from my mother's unblinking stare. She'd been watching my reaction since they released me from the hospital. She was the first to reach me that night when my screaming woke the neighbors, and she was the one who caught me crying in my closet the next day. But it was only after she found me 2 days later, dazed and blinking, and clutching a shard of a broken mirror in my bloody hand, that she insisted on getting me help. What I got was a diagnosis, post-traumatic stress disorder, the psychologist said. Nightmares and visual hallucinations were my new normal, apparently, and something about my behavior in the psychologist's office made him recommend a long-term care facility. I couldn't let that happen. I recommended moving instead. I remembered the way my mother's eyes narrowed when I brought it up a few days after the disastrous appointment. So wary. So cautious. Like I was a bomb under her bed. I really think it will help, I said, not believing that at all. But I had been nightmare-free for 2 nights, and the mirror episode I didn't remember was apparently the only one. The psychologist was overreacting, just like my mother. Why do you think so? My mother's voice was casual and even. But her nails were still bitten down to the beds. I tried to recall the mostly one-sided conversation I had with the psychologist. She was always in this house. I can't look at anything without thinking about her. And if I go back to school, I'll see her there too. But I want to go back to school. I need to. I need to think about something else. I'll talk to your father about it, she said, her eyes searching my face. I could see in every crease of her forehead, every tilt of her chin, that she didn't understand how her daughter could have gotten here. How I could have snuck out of the house and ended up in the last place I should. She had asked me as much, but of course I had no answer. I heard my brother's voice out of nowhere. I think it's almost over, Daniel said. My heartbeat slowed as I looked up at my older brother, and as he predicted, the priest then asked us all to bow our heads and pray. I shifted uncomfortably, the brittle grass crunching under my boots, and glanced at my mother. We weren't religious, and frankly, I wasn't sure what to do. If there was some protocol for how to behave at your best friend's funeral, I didn't get the memo. But my mother tilted her head, her short black hair falling against her perfect skin, as she appraised me, examined me, to see what I'd choose. I looked away. After an eternity of seconds, heads lifted as if eager for it to be over, and the crowd dissolved. Daniel stood beside me while my classmates took turns telling me how sorry they were, promising to stay in touch after the move. I hadn't been in school since the day of the accident, but some of them had come to visit me in the hospital, probably just out of curiosity. No one asked me how it happened, and I was glad because I couldn't tell them. I still didn't know. Squawking pierced the funeral's hushed atmosphere as hundreds of black birds flew overhead in a rush of beating wings. They settled on a cluster of leafless trees that overlooked the parking lot. Even the trees were wearing black. I faced my brother. "Didn't you park under those crows?" He nodded and started walking to his car. "Fabulous," I said as I followed him. "Now we're going to have to dodge crap from the whole flock." "Murder." I stopped. "What?" Daniel turned around. "It's called a murder of crows, not a flock. And yes, we're going to dodge avian fecal matter, unless you want to go with Mom and Dad." I smiled, relieved without knowing why. "Pass. Thought so." Daniel waited for me, and I was grateful for the escape. I glanced back to make sure my mother wasn't watching, but she was busy talking to Rachel's family, whom we'd known for years. It was too easy to forget that my parents were leaving everything behind, too. My father's law practice, my mother's patience. And Joseph, though only 12, accepted without much explanation that we were moving and agreed to leave his friends without complaint. When I thought about it, I knew I had won the family lottery. I made a mental note to behave more charitably toward my mother. After all, it wasn't her fault we were leaving. It was mine. Chapter 4. 8 weeks later. Miami, Florida. "You're killing me, Mara. Give me a minute." I squinted at the spider that stood between me and my breakfast banana. She and I were working out an arrangement. "Well, let me do it, then. We're going to be late." Daniel was getting his panties in a bunch at the thought. Mr. Perfect was always punctual. "No, you'll kill it. And then it will be dead. And just imagine it," I spoke, my eyes never leaving my arachnid opponent. "The spider family bereft of their matriarch, her spider children waiting in their web, watching for mother for days on end before they realize she's been murdered." "She?" "Yes." I tilted my head at the spider. "Her name is Roxanne." "Of course it is. Take Roxanne outside before she meets the op-ed section of Joseph's Wall Street Journal." I paused. "Why is our brother getting the Wall Street Journal?" "He thinks it's funny." I smiled. It was. I turned to stare at Roxanne, who had sidestepped an inch or two in response to Daniel's threat. I held out the paper towel and reached for her, but recoiled involuntarily. For the past 10 minutes, I'd been repeating this motion, reaching and withdrawing. I wanted to shepherd Roxanne to freedom, to deliver her from our kitchen and lead her to a land flowing with the blood of myriad flying insects, a land otherwise known as our backyard. But it seemed I was not up to the task. I was still hungry, though, and wanted my banana. I reached for her again, my hand stuck in midair. Daniel heaved a melodramatic sigh and stuck a cup in the microwave. He pressed a few buttons and the tray began revolving. "You shouldn't stand in front of the microwave." Daniel ignored me. "You could get a brain tumor." "Oh, is that a fact?" he asked. "Do you want to find out?" Daniel examined my hand, still suspended between my body and Roxanne's, paralyzed. "Your level of neuroses will only find love in a made-for-TV movie." "Perhaps, but I'll be tumorless." "Don't you want to be tumorless, Daniel?" He reached into the pantry and withdrew a cereal bar. "Here," he said, and tossed it at me. But lately, I was useless before noon. It fell with a thud on the countertop beside me. Roxanne scurried away, and I lost track of her. Daniel grabbed his keys and sauntered toward the front door. I followed him into the blinding sunlight, breakfastless. "Come on," he said with false cheer. "Don't tell me you aren't psyched beyond belief for our first day of school." He dodged the tiny lizards that scurried across the slate walkway of our new house.
Again. I wonder if it's snowing in Laurelton right now. Probably. That I won't miss. Just when I thought it wasn't possible to get any hotter, the interior of Daniel's Civic proved me wrong. I choked on the heat and motioned for Daniel to open the window while I sputtered. He looked at me strangely. What? It's not that hot. I'm dying. You're not dying? No, it's like 72 degrees. Ugh, guess I'm not used to it yet, I said. We'd moved to Florida only a few weeks ago, but I wouldn't recognize my old life in a lineup. I hated this place. Daniel's eyebrows were still lifted, but he changed the subject. You know, Mom was planning to drive you to school separately today. I groaned. I didn't want to play the patient this morning, or any morning, actually. I contemplated buying her knitting needles or a watercolor set. She needed a hobby that didn't involve hovering over me. Thanks for taking me instead. I met Daniel's eyes. I mean it. No problemo, he said, and flashed a goofy smile before turning into I-95 and into traffic. My brother spent a large portion of the agonizingly slow drive to school banging his forehead on the steering wheel. We were late, and as we pulled into the full parking lot, there was a single student among the glossy luxury cars. I reached behind me for Daniel's neat and tidy backpack, which was positioned in the back seat like a passenger. I grabbed it for him and launched myself out of the car. We approached the elaborately scrolled iron gate of the Croydon Academy of the Arts and Sciences, our new institution of higher learning. A giant crest was wrought into the gate, a shield in the center with a thick band extending from the top right to the bottom left, separating it into halves. There was a knight's helmet crowning the shield, and two lions on either side. The school looked oddly out of place, considering the rundown neighborhood. So, what I didn't tell you is Mom's picking you up this afternoon, Daniel said. Traitor, I mumbled. I know, but I need to meet with one of the guidance counselors about my college applications, and she's only free after school today. What's the point? You know you're going to get in everywhere. That is far from certain, he said. I squinted one of my eyes at Daniel. What are you doing? He asked. This is me, giving you the side eye. I continued to squint. Well, you look like you're having a stroke. Anyway, Mom's going to pick you up over there, my brother said, pointing to a cul-de-sac on the other side of the campus. Try to behave. I stifled a yawn. It's too early to be such an asshat, Daniel. And watch your language, it's unbecoming. Who cares? I lolled my head back as we walked, reading the names of illustrious Croydon alumni inscribed in the brick archway above our heads. Most were along the lines of Heathcliff Rotterdam III, Parker Preston XVI, Annalise Bennett Vaughn. I heard Joseph call someone that the other day. He's picking it up from you. I laughed. It's not funny, Daniel said. Please, it's just a word. He opened his mouth to respond when I heard Chopin emerge from his pocket. The sound of Chopin, not the actual Chopin, thank God. Daniel picked up his phone and mouthed Mom to me, then pointed at the glass wall that housed the administration office of Croydon Academy. Go, he said, and I did. Without my brother distracting me, I was able to fully absorb the campus in its immaculate, over-landscaped splendor. Fat blades of emerald grass anchored the grounds, clipped within a millimeter of uniformity. A sprawling courtyard divided the campus into blooming, flower-framed quadrants. One section housed the gaudily becolumned library, another the cafeteria and windowless gymnasium. The classroom and administration office dominated the last two quadrants. Open-air archways and brick paths connected the structures and led to a gurgling fountain in the center of the lawn. I half expected to see woodland creatures burst forth from the buildings and break into song. Everything about the place shrieked, "We are perfect here, and you will be too." Ugh, no wonder why my mother chose it. I felt grossly underdressed in my t-shirt and jeans. Uniforms were required at Croydon, but thanks to our late transfers, ours hadn't arrived yet. Switching from public school to private as a junior, and in the middle of the trimester no less, would have been torment enough without the added insult of plaid skirts and knee socks. But my mother was a snob, and didn't trust the public schools in such a big city. And after everything that had happened in December, I was in no shape to argue coherently about it. I picked up our schedules and maps from the school secretary and headed back outside as Daniel hung up the phone. "How's Mom?" I asked. My brother half-shrugged. "Just checking in." He looked over the paperwork for me. We've missed first period, so your first class is... Daniel fumbled with the papers and declared, Algebra 2. Perfect. Just perfect. His eyes scanned the open-air campus. The classroom doors led directly outside, like the structure of a motel. After a few seconds, Daniel pointed to the farther building. It should be there, on the other side of that corner. Listen, he said. I might not see you until lunch. Do you want to eat with me or something? I have to speak to the principal and the head of the music department, but I can find you after. No, it's fine. I'll be fine. Really? Because there's no one I'd rather eat mystery meat with. My brother smiled, but I could tell he was anxious. Daniel had kept a big brotherly eye on me ever since I was released from the hospital, though he was less obvious about it, and therefore less irritating, than our mother. But as such, I had to work extra hard to reassure him that I would not crack today. I put on my best mask of adolescent ennui and wore it like armor as we approached the building. Really, I'm fine, I said, rolling my eyes for effect. Now go, before you fail out of high school and die poor and lonely. I shoved him lightly for emphasis, and we separated. But as I walked away, my little facade started to crumble. How ridiculous. This wasn't my first day of kindergarten, though it was my first day of school without Rachel. Ever. But it was the first of many. I needed to get a grip. I swallowed back the ache that rose in my throat and tried to decipher my schedule. AP English, Miss Lieb, room B35. Algebra 2, Mr. Walsh, room 264. American History, Mrs. McCreary, room 4. Art, Mrs. Gallo, room L. Spanish 1, Miss Morales, room 213. Biology 2, Mrs. Prieta, Annex. Hopeless. I wandered the path to the building and scanned the room numbers, but found the vending machines before I found my algebra classroom. Four of them in a row, pushed up against the back of the building, facing a series of tiki huts that dotted the grounds. They reminded me that I'd skipped breakfast. I looked around. I was already late. A few more minutes couldn't hurt. I set the papers down on the ground and dug in my bag for change, but as I inserted one quarter in the machine, the other one I held in my hand fell. I bent to search for it, as I only had enough money to buy one thing. I finally found it, placed it in the machine, and clicked on the letter-number combination that would provide my salvation. It stuck. Unbelievable. I clicked the numbers again. Nothing. My M&Ms were trapped by the machine. I grabbed the sides of the machine and tried to shake it. No dice. Then I kicked it. Still nothing. I glared at the machine. Let them out! I punctuated my statement with a few more useless kicks. You have an anger management problem. I whipped around at the sound of the warm, lilting British accent behind me. The person it belonged to sat on the picnic table under the tiki hut. His general state of disarray was almost enough to distract me from his face. The boy, if he could be called that, looked like he belonged in college, not high school, wore chucks with holes worn through, no laces, slim charcoal pants, and a white button-down shirt covered his lean, spare frame. His tie was loose, his cuffs were undone, and his blazer lay in a heap beside him as he lazily leaned back on the palms of his hands. His strong jaw and chin were slightly scruffy, as though he hadn't shaved in days, and his eyes looked gray in the shade. Strands of his dark chestnut hair stuck out every which way. Bedroom hair. He could be considered pale in comparison to everyone else I'd observed in Florida thus far, which is to say he was an orange. He was beautiful, and he was smiling at me. Chapter 5. Smiling at me like he knew me, I turned my head, wondering if there was anyone behind me. Nope, no one there. When I glanced back in the boy's direction, he was gone. I blinked, disoriented, and bent to pick up my things. I heard footsteps approach, but they stopped just before they reached me. The perfectly tanned blonde girl wore heeled Oxfords and white knee socks with her just-above-the-knee charcoal and navy plaid skirt. The fact that I'd been wearing the same thing in a week hurt my soul. She was linked arm in arm with a flawlessly groomed, startlingly enormous blonde boy, and the two of them in their Croydon-crested blazers looked down their perfect noses with their perfect smattering of freckles at me. "Watch it," the girl said with venom. "Watch what?" I hadn't done anything. But I decided not to say so, considering I knew exactly one person at that school and we shared a last name. "Sorry," I said, even though I didn't know what for. "I'm Mara Dyer. I'm new here." "Obviously." A hollow smile crept over vending machine girl's puritanically pretty face. "Welcome," she said, and the two of them walked away. Funny, I did not feel welcome at all. I shook off both strange encounters and, map in hand, circled the building with no results. I climbed the stairs and circled it again before finally finding my classroom. The door was closed. I did not relish the idea of walking in late, or at all, really, but I'd already missed one class, and I was there, and the hell with it. I opened the door and stepped inside. Cracks appeared in the classroom walls as 20-something heads turned in my direction. The fissures spidered up higher and higher until the ceiling began to crumble. My throat went dry. No one said a word, even though dust filled the room, even though I thought I would choke. Because it wasn't happening to anyone else, just to me. A light crashed to the floor right in front of the teacher, sending a shower of sparks in my direction. Not real, but I tried to avoid them anyway, and fell. I heard the sound of my face as it smacked against the polished linoleum floor. Then pain punched me between my eyes. Warm blood gushed out of my nostrils and swirled over my mouth and under my chin. My eyes were open, but I still couldn't see through the gray dust. I could hear, though. There was a collective intake of breath from the class, and a sputtering teacher tried to determine just how hurt I was. Oddly, I did nothing but lie on the cool floor and ignore the muffled voices around me. I preferred my bubble of pain to the humiliation I would surely face upon standing. Are you okay? Can you hear me? The teacher's voice grew increasingly panicky. I tried to say my name, but I think it sounded more like, "I'm dying," instead. "Someone go get Nurse Lucas before she bleeds to death in my classroom." At that, I scrambled up, shifting woozily on alien feet. Nothing like the threat of nurses and their needles to get my ass into gear. "I'm fine," I announced and looked around the room. Just a normal classroom. No dust. No cracks. "Really," I said. "No need for the nurse. I just get nosebleeds sometimes." Chuckle, chuckle. Laugh it off. "I don't even feel anything." The bleeding stopped. And it had. Though I probably looked like a freak show. The teacher eyed me warily before he answered. "You really aren't hurt, then? Would you like to go to the restroom to clean up? We can formally introduce ourselves upon your return." "Yeah, thanks," I answered. "I'll be right back." I willed myself out of my dizziness and snuck a glance at the teacher and my new classmates. Every face in the room registered a mixture of surprise and horror, including, I noticed, vending machine girl. Lovely. I vacated the classroom. My body felt wiggly as I walked, like a loose tooth that could be dislodged by the slightest force. When I no longer heard the whispers or the teacher's shaky voice, I almost broke into a run. I even missed the girls' bathroom at first, barely registering the swinging door. I doubled back, and once inside, focused on the pattern of the hideous yolk-colored tile, counted the number of the stalls, did anything I could to avoid looking at myself in the mirror. I tried to calm myself, hoping to stave off the panic attack that would follow the sight of blood. I breathed slowly. I did not want to clean myself up. I did not want to return to class. But the longer I was gone, the higher the likelihood that the teacher would send the nurse after me. I really didn't want that. So I positioned myself in front of the wet counter, which was covered in wads of crumpled paper towels, and looked up. The girl in the mirror smiled, but she wasn't me. Chapter 6. It was Claire. Her red hair spilled over my shoulders where my brown hair should have been. Then her reflection bent, sinister in the glass. The room tilted, pitching me to the side. I bit my tongue, then braced my hands on the counter. When I looked up at the mirror, it was once again my face that stared back. My heart pounded against my ribcage. It was nothing. Just like the classroom was nothing. I was okay. Nervous about my first day of school, maybe. My disastrous first day of school. But at least I was unsettled enough that my stomach forgot to churn at the sight of the drying blood on my skin. I grabbed a handful of paper towels from the dispenser and wetted them. I brought them to my face to clean it up, but the pungent, wet paper towel smell finally set my stomach roiling. I willed myself not to vomit. I failed. I had the presence of mind to pull back my long hair from my face as I emptied the meager contents of my stomach into the sink. At that moment, I was glad that the universe had thwarted my attempts at breakfast. When I finished dry heaving, I wiped my mouth, gargled some water, and spit it into the sink. A thin film of sweat covered my skin, which had that unmistakable just-puked pallor. A charming first impression, to be sure. At least my t-shirt had escaped my bodily fluids. I leaned on the sink. If I skipped the rest of algebra, the teacher would just rustle up a mathlete posse to find me and make sure I hadn't died. So I bravely headed into the relentless heat and made my way back. The classroom door was still open. I'd forgotten to close it after my unceremonious departure, and I heard the teacher droning on about an equation. I took a deep breath and carefully walked in. In seconds, the teacher was at my side. His thick glasses gave his eyes an insect-like quality. Creepy. "Oh, you look much better. Please have a seat right here. I'm Mr. Walsh, by the way. I didn't catch your name before." "It's Mara. Mara Dyer," I said thickly. "Well, Miss Dyer, you certainly know how to make an entrance." The class's low chuckle hovered in the air. "Yeah, just clumsy, I guess." I sat down in the first row, where Mr. Walsh had indicated, in an empty desk parallel to the teacher's and closest to the door. Every seat in the row was unoccupied, except mine. For 8 painful minutes and 27 infinite seconds, I sat sweltering in the seventh circle of my own personal inferno, motionless at my desk. I listened to the sound of the teacher's voice, but heard nothing. Shame drowned him out, and every pore of my skin felt painfully naked, open for exploitation by the pillaging eyes of my classmates. I tried not to focus on the assault of whispers that I could hear but not decipher. I patted the back of my tingling head, as if the heat of the anonymous stares managed to burn through my hair, exposing my scalp. I looked desperately at the door, wishing to escape this nightmare, but I knew that the whispers would only spread as soon as I was outside. The bell rang, marking the end of my first class at Croydon. A resounding success indeed. I hung back from the mass exodus toward the door, knowing I'd need a book and a briefing on where the class was in the syllabus. Mr. Walsh told me ever so politely that I was expected to take the trimester exam in 3 weeks like everyone else, then returned to his desk to shuffle papers, and left me to face the rest of my morning. It was blissfully uneventful. When lunch rolled around, I gathered my book-laden messenger bag and heaved it over my shoulder. I decided to look around for a quiet, secluded place to sit and read the book I'd brought with me. My vomiting shenanigans had ruined my appetite. I hopped down the stairs, two at a time, walked to the edge of the grounds, and stopped at the fence that bordered a large plot of undeveloped land. Trees towered above the school, casting one building entirely in shadow. The eerie screech of a bird punctured the breezeless air. I was in some preppy Jurassic Park nightmare, definitely. I violently opened my book to where I'd left off, but found myself reading and rereading the same paragraph before I gave up. That lump rose in my throat again. I slumped against the chain-link fence, the metal scoring marks in my flesh through the thin fabric of my shirt, and closed my eyes and defeat. Someone laughed behind me. My head snapped up as my blood froze. It was Jude's laugh, Jude's voice. I stood slowly and faced the fence, the jungle, as I hooked my fingers in the metal and searched for the source. Nothing but trees, of course, because Jude was dead, like Claire and Rachel. Which meant that I'd had 3 hallucinations in less than 3 hours, which wasn't good. I turned back to the campus. It was empty. I glanced at my watch, and panic set in. Only a minute to spare before my next class. I swallowed hard, grabbed my bag, and rushed to the nearest building. But as I rounded the corner, I stopped cold. Jude stood 40 feet away. I knew he couldn't be there, that he wasn't there, but he was there, unfriendly and unsmiling beneath the brim of the Patriots baseball cap he never took off, looking like he wanted to talk. I turned away and picked up my pace. I walked away from him, slowly at first, then ran. I glanced over my shoulder once, just to see if he was still there. He was. and he was close.
Chapter 7. By some stroke of luck, I flung open the door to the closest classroom, 213, and it turned out to be Spanish. And judging by all the taken desks, I was already late.
Miss Diaz?
The teacher boomed. Distracted and disturbed, I pulled the door closed behind me. It's Dyer, actually. For my correction or for my lateness, I'll never know. The teacher punished me, forced me to stand at the front of the room while she fired question after question at me in Spanish, to which I could only respond, I don't know. She didn't even introduce herself. She just sat there, the muscles twitching in her veiny forearms as she scribbled self-importantly in her teacher book. The Spanish Inquisition took on a whole new meaning. And it continued for a solid 20 minutes. When she finally stopped, she made me sit in the desk next to hers, in the front of the class, facing all of the other students. Brutal. My eyes were glued to the clock as I counted the seconds until it was over. When the bell rang, I bolted for the door.
"You look like you could use a hug," said a voice from behind me.
I turned around to face a smiling short boy wearing an open white button-down shirt. A yellow t-shirt that said, "I am a cliché," was beneath it.
"That's very generous of you," I said, plastering a smile on my face. "But I think I'll manage." It was important to act not crazy.
"Oh, I wasn't offering. Just making an observation." The boy pushed his wild dreadlocks out of his eyes and held out his hand. "I'm Jamie Roth."
"Mara Dyer," I said, though we already knew.
"Wait, are you new here?" A mischievous grin reached his dark eyes. I matched it.
"Funny. You're funny."
He gave an exaggerated bow. "Don't worry about Morales, by the way. She's the world's worst teacher."
"So she's that heinous to everyone?"
I asked, after we were a safe distance away from the classroom. I scanned the campus for imagined dead people as I shifted my bag to my other shoulder. There were none. So far, so good.
"Maybe not that heinous, but close. You're lucky she didn't throw any chalk at you, actually. How's your nose, by the way?"
Had he been in Algebra 2 this morning?
"Better, thanks. You're the first person to ask, or say anything nice at all, actually."
"So people have said not nice things, then?" I thought I glimpsed a flash of silver in his mouth when he spoke. A tongue stud? Interesting. He didn't seem the type. I nodded as my eyes drank in my new classmates. I knew there were variants of the school uniform, different shirt, blazer, and skirt and pants options, and sweater vests for the really adventurous. But when I looked for any telltale signs of cliques, wild shoes, or students with dyed black hair and makeup to match, I saw none. It was more than the uniforms. Everyone somehow managed to look exactly alike. Perfectly groomed, perfectly well-behaved, not a hair out of place. Jamie, with his dreadlocks and tongue stud and exposed t-shirt, was one of the only standouts. And, of course, the disheveled-looking person from this morning. I felt an elbow in my ribs.
"So new chick. Who said what? Don't leave a fella hangin'."
I smiled. There was this girl earlier who told me to watch it. I described vending machine girl to Jamie and watched his eyebrows rise.
"The guy she was with was equally unfriendly," I finished.
Jamie shook his head. "You went near Shaw, didn't you?" Then he smiled to himself. "God, he really is something. Does this Shaw happen to have an overabundance of muscles and wear his shirt with a popped collar?" "He was on the arm of said girl." Jamie laughed. That description could fit any number of Croydon douches, but definitely not Noah Shaw. Probably Davis, if I had to guess. I raised my eyebrows. "Aiden Davis, lacrosse all-star and Project Runway aficionado. Pre-Shaw, he and Anna used to date, until he came out of the metaphorical closet and now they're BFFs forever." Jamie batted his eyelashes. I kind of loved him.
"So, what did you do to Anna?" he asked.
I gave him a look of mock horror.
"What did I do to her?"
"Well, you did something to get her attention. You'd normally be beneath her notice, but the claws will come out if Shaw starts sniffing around you," he said. He took a long look at me before he spoke again. Which he will, having exhausted Croydon's limited female resources already, literally. "Well, she needn't trouble herself." I shuffled my schedule in my map, then looked around, trying to locate the annex for biology.
I have no interest in sealing someone's boyfriend, I said. Or dating at all, I didn't say, considering my last boyfriend was now dead. Oh, he's not her boyfriend. Shaw dropped her ass last year after a couple of weeks. A record for him. Then, she went even crazier, like the rest of them. Hill hath no fury like a woman scorned and all that jazz. Anna used to be the abstinence poster girl, but post-Shaw, you could write a comic book about the many adventures of her vagina. It could wear a cape. I snorted. My eyes scanned the buildings in front of me. None of them looked like an annex. And the guy she was all cozy with has no problem with this? I asked, distracted. Jamie quirked an eyebrow at me. The Mean Queen? That would be no. Ah, how'd he earn the nickname? Jamie looked at me like I was an idiot. I mean, specifically, I said, trying not to be one. Let's just say I tried to make friends with Davis once, in the platonic sense, Jamie clarified. I'm not his type. Anyway, my jaw still clicks when I yawn. He demonstrated it for me. He hit you? The fountain burbled behind us as we crossed the quad and stopped in front of the building farthest from the administration offices. I inspected the labels on the classroom doors, completely random. I would never figure this place out. Indeed, Davis has a vicious right hook. We had that in common, apparently. I got him back later, though. Oh? Jamie wouldn't stand a chance in a knife fight with Aiden Davis if all Aiden had was a roll of toilet paper. Jamie smiled knowingly. I threatened him with Ebola. I blinked. I don't actually have Ebola. It's a biosafety level 4 hot agent. I blinked again. In other words, impossible for teenagers to obtain, even if your father is a doctor. He looked disappointed. Right, I said, not moving. But Davis believed it and almost soiled himself. It was a defining moment for me, until that rat bastard tattled to the guidance counselors, who believed him, and called my dad to verify I didn't actually have Ebola at home. Idiots. One little joke involving hemorrhagic fever and they brand you unstable. He shook his head, then his mouth tilted into a smile. You're like totally freaked out right now. No, I was just a tad. But who was I to be picky in the friend department? He winked and nodded. Sure. So what class do you have next? Biology with Prieta? In the annex? Wherever the hell that is. Jamie pointed to an enormous flowered bush about 1,000 feet away, in the opposite direction. Behind the bougainvillea. Thanks, I said, peering at it. I never would have found it. So what's your next class? He shrugged out of his blazer and button-down. AP Physics, normally, but I'm skipping it. AP Physics, impressive. So, are you in my grade? I'm a junior, Jamie said. He must have registered my skepticism because he quickly added, I skipped a grade. Probably absorbed my parents' short genes by osmosis. Osmosis? Don't you mean genetics? I asked. Not that you're short. A lie, but harmless. I'm adopted, Jamie said. And please, I'm short, no biggie. Jamie shrugged, then tapped his watchless wrist. You'd better get to Prieta's class before you're late, he waved. See ya. Bye. And just like that, I made a friend. I mentally patted myself on the back. Daniel would be proud. Mom would be prouder. I planned to offer this news to her like a cat presenting a dead mouse to its owner. It might even be enough to help stave off therapy. If, of course, I kept today's hallucinations to myself. Chapter 8. I managed to survive the rest of the day without being hospitalized or committed, and after school ended, Mom was waiting for me at the cul-de-sac exactly as Daniel said she would be. She excelled at those small mom moments and didn't disappoint today. Mara, honey, how was your first day? Her voice bubbled with over-enthusiasm. She pushed up her sunglasses over her hair and leaned in to give me a kiss. Then she stiffened. What happened? What? You have blood on your neck. Damn, I thought I'd washed it all off. I had a nosebleed. The truth, but not the whole truth, so help me. My mother was quiet. Her eyes were narrowed and full of concern. Par for the course, and so irritating. What? You've never had a nosebleed in your life. I wanted to ask, how would you know? But unfortunately, she would know. Once upon a time, I used to tell her everything. Those days were over. I dug my heels in. I had one today. Out of nowhere, randomly. She gave me that piercing therapist stare, that one that says, you're full of it. I wasn't going to admit, that I thought I saw my classroom